Okay, let's get started. I'm Chad Olson. I'm not the chairman. I'm the vice chair. We don't have a chairman. Henry, I've tried to talk to becoming the chairman. He refuses. Our previous chairman...
Yeah, sorry.
Stop. We got the sign-in sheet. We've agreed to spend at least 80 pesos each plus tip for our free use of the meeting room. Not hard to do. And since we know that we do not have free will, you would eat any time you want to anyway, right? And I'm going to introduce our speaker by way of video to you. And then... have some discussion later and talk about the September meeting. Henry and I are both going to be gone. I'm suggesting we skip next meeting. And I do have a presentation for October. Okay. About Dr. Bill Warner. Before he began writing books about Islam, Dr. Warner was an applied physicist trained in quantum physics and a university professor at Tennessee. He holds a PhD in both physics and mathematics. Dr. Warner has had a long life interest in religion and its effects on history. He has studied the source texts of the major religions for decades, I think since he retired as the university professor, which I think is about 30 years ago. Even before the destruction of the World Trade Center, he had predicted the war between Islam and America. The day after 9/11, he decided to devote his time to make the source texts of Islam available to the average person. Dr. Warner's training in scientific theory and mathematics shaped how he analyzed the Islamic texts. The first step he found to realize that the Islamic texts are deliberately difficult to read and comprehend. A program, the Trilogy Project, he called it, was created to strip away the confusion in the text. It became clear that Islam is not constructed on the same principles as most are in the rest of the world. He applied simple statistical methods to reveal that dualism, the doctrine that the world or reality consists of two basic, opposed, and irreducible principles that account for all that exists, and submission, in this case to Islam, are the fundamental principles of Islamic doctrine. He applied these statistical methods, and they showed to him, anyway, that Islam is far more of a political system than a religion. And there is no unmitigated good in Islam for the kafir, that's the non-Muslim. Islam's ethical system is dualistic and is not based on the golden rule. Do unto others, of course. Islamic doctrine cannot be reconciled with our concepts of human rights and the American Constitution, like you said. A great majority, 96%, of all Islamic doctrine about women subjugates them. The Sunnah, which is what Muhammad did and said, is more important than the Quran in a Muslim's everyday life. It is difficult to understand any Muslim or Islamic action without knowing the doctrine that is its cause. Now, he founded the study of political Islam, and is its director. His books focus on Islamic law, and he uses Islamic texts as his primary sources of evidence. He draws his conclusions from them and quotes from them copiously. He considers the life of the Prophet Muhammad as the key factor in understanding Islam and how it should be practiced. To know Islam, you must know Muhammad. His life and sayings are the foundations of Islam. It is more important to know Muhammad than the Quran. It's worth repeating here, because Dr. Werner does, that these two key principles that underlie Islam's political system, and they are dualism, particularly moral dualism, and by that is the conflict between good and evil. They are good, everybody else is evil, and there's no two ways about it. And submission here is to the hierarchies that Islam imposes. You have to follow the rules. Okay, with that, and if there's any other discussion later on that you'd like to bring up, we can certainly do that.
Is that another computer?
No, it's just a thing for keeping, letting the air flow.
And here we have Dr. Werner.
So I can see where this is.
Here, the Council of American Islamic Relations has issued some guidelines on how to talk about post-jihad events. And they say, please let's not help Islamic State recruit more terrorists by blaming all Muslims for heinous acts. Well, I don't want to blame any Muslims, because I don't blame the Muslims for acts of jihad. I blame the doctrine of Islam. And you see, all Muslims share one thing, and that all Muslims includes jihadists, or murderers, or terrorists, if you have to call them the non-jihad word. And that is, all Muslims have the same doctrine, have the same Quran, the same Sunnah, the same Sharia. So therefore, what the jihadist has in common with all Muslims is Allahu Akbar, because they all worship the same God. Now, we don't want to blame all Muslims for this, but we do need to understand that they have an underlying ideology which they share. All Muslims share the same ideology, including jihadists. Now, they give us another piece of advice, which is don't call terrorists jihadists. You know, I agree with that. Black Lives Matter has some terrorists within it, but we shouldn't call them jihadists. No, we need to use the duck theory. It walks like a duck, looks like a duck, quacks like a duck, it's a duck. And so when we see someone who's yelling Allahu Akbar and killing kafirs, guess what? It's jihad. It is not terrorism. They may include the technique of terror, but they are primarily jihadists. So in this particular case, I agree with the Council on American Islamic Relations. Let's not call murderers terrorists. Let's call them jihadists. And let's not blame all Muslims for the act of jihadists, but let's do understand this. They share the same ideology in common. Every Muslim has within them their ideology, jihad. So let's just recognize that and see that all Muslims share the same ideology, including jihad. Thank you.
I meant to tell you that we have five of these. And each one, this is 2 minutes. The next ones are all longer, 4 or 5, and the last one is 9 minutes long.
I was reading a book on brain physiology and its relationship to charity, and I thought it had some interesting points to make about Islam. You see, if you study the brain and how it's wired, it turns out that when we do good for others, it produces in us a good feeling. That is, we have a sympathetic connection. Now, of course, this may be one of our tendencies, and it's part of our nature, but this does not mean that everybody's going to always be doing nice things for other people. Obviously, there's some socialization that can overcome the instincts. We see this in other areas as well. Now, one of the expressions of sympathy is the golden rule. Do unto others as you would have them do unto you. Which others? All others. But yet we see in Muhammad's life that one of the expressions of the golden rule, which is to be a good neighbor, that he attacked pagans, Jews, and Christians. He attacked all of his neighbors. And so this is just an example of the fact that Islam does not have a golden rule. Now, Muslims like to say that it does, but I challenge them to point this out in either the Quran or the Hadith or the Sirah. Indeed, the Quran says that kafirs are worse than animals. Allah hates kafirs and has made some kafirs for the sole purpose of burning in hell. It goes further to say in 12 different verses that a Muslim is never the friend of a kafir. Now, this does not mean that Muslims can't be friendly to kafirs, but it does mean that they're never a true friend. Now, the distinction is we've met many friendly salesmen and know that they're not truly our friend. Now, since these 12 verses are in the Quran, I've often wondered why the Quran is not viewed as hate speech. Now, by the way, I'm against hate speech laws. I'm for full-throated speech. So I'm not criticizing Islam here. I'm just saying that you would think that all of those who are running around in our law system saying, well, this is hate speech, could add one more. Now, sympathy comes from putting ourselves in place of others, and yet a Muslim cannot put themselves in the place of a Kafir. I was in a debate one time, and I made very clear that the person I was debating, who was a Muslim, knew that I am a Kafir. And he said, why would you insist on that? It's the worst word. I said, yes, Kafir is the worst word, and I want you to know that I know your dirty little word, and I'm laying claim to it. So how could a Muslim be sympathetic with something that is the worst creature in the world? Now, our brains are wired to be sympathetic, and yet doctrine can overcome that. So what happens is that the wiring in our brains overcomes Islamic doctrine in the heads of many Muslims. And they do feel like they are Kafirs and they're their friends. But that's because they're listening to their brain and not Islamic doctrine. Now, as a personal judgment, I happen to think this lack of friendship, lack of sympathy, is the worst aspect of Islamic doctrine. And it's the reason I always try to tell people what the Kafir is, so that they can understand that they are cut off from humanity, or at least Islam's view of humanity. I dislike the Kafir laws, but the Kafir judgment of the Quran, because it places a barrier between people. And I actually happen to believe that humanity is one spirit, but the Kafir doctrine overcomes this one spirit sympathetic view of humanity. And that's the reason I oppose political Islam, or at least one of the main reasons. Thank you.
Can you hear it okay back there?
Mm-hmm.
I have a bit of a problem with his accent. Kind of an accent does he have?
Southern, I think.
Oh.
Non-Dutch.
Everyone has heard of Sharia law. The point is that Sharia is much more than law. It's much more than courts and legal decisions, although it does include that. It's actually a manual for a civilization. It includes customs, attitudes, manners, theology, philosophy, how to knock at a door, how to say hello, how to have sex, how to raise children, and how to relate to Kafir. And if you're a Kafir, you need to know that you're already following some aspect of Sharia. Now, by the way, no nation is 100% Sharia, even Saudi Arabia, for instance, although Sharia definitely influences its entire legal system. The reason is that Sharia is not sophisticated enough for the modern life. Countries that use a great deal of Sharia are Saudi Arabia, Sudan, Iran, Iraq, Afghanistan, Yemen. Now, what's important is that nations can choose a little or a lot of Sharia, but if you're Islamic, you'll always have some Sharia. In the early 20s, Kemal Ataturk basically had a revolution in Turkey, and the Sharia was fairly well done away with. But today, the Sharia is to Turkey. Now, unbeknownst to you, you're already following the Sharia here in America, or at least America's following it for you. Here's one of the ways we follow Sharia. Have you heard any good Muhammad jokes? You've heard jokes about St. Peter, Jesus, and God, but I bet you've never heard one about Muhammad. And what about those cartoons, the Muhammad cartoons? Remember those? And in Tennessee today, and through the rest of America, textbooks increasingly tell only the Islamic side of history. A clerk who's a Muslim may apply for a job, and then when they get it, show up wearing a hijab and demand that they be allowed to wear their hijab on the job. Now, it's sometimes what's important is what you don't see. And the next time you go to a movie and the bad guys are white or black, ask yourself this question. How come they never seem to be Muslim? A way that the Sharia is followed in America is at interfaith gatherings in which Christians, Jews, and Muslims get together. The rules forbid the Muslims being offended. Well, that's one of the ways of following the Sharia. There's no critical study that I'm aware of in any university or college about Islam. Now, when I say a critical study, I don't mean a survey 101 religions of the world. I'm talking about really criticizing aspects of the Quran. One of the ways that we follow the Sharia is we've adapted our language so that we never offend Muslims. There's no jihad. It's terrorism. And then we have the newest non-word, which is combating violent extremism. If you want to measure this, read the 9/11 report. If you read the first 9/11 report, it includes words like Islam, jihad, and Muslim. No more, they're gone. Sharia financing and banking are being increasingly accepted in the United States and Europe. Law enforcement only uses Muslims to translate Arabic. But then again, law enforcement here in Tennessee can only be trained by those approved by the Muslim Brotherhood. The same is true at the federal level. Here in Tennessee and the rest of America, textbooks, if they deal with Islam, are written by Muslims. And here's what's important. The state of Tennessee enforces Sharia by, if you ask a question, you're only allowed to be graded correct by giving an Islamic answer. One of the things that you're taught in textbooks now is that Christians, Jews, and Muslims all worship the same God, which is a load of bunk. But that's the only acceptable answer. So in the state of Tennessee, if you ask the question, do Christians, Jews, and Muslims worship the same God, and you say no, the state says you're wrong. They enforce the Sharia. There are refugees coming to America. Only those approved by the OIC, Organization of Islamic Cooperation, get to come here. Have you ever noticed that we hear talk about Syrian refugees, but how come we don't hear about Christian refugees? Well, the Organization of Islamic Cooperation in the United Nations determines who we get, and the Sharia says that the Muslim must always be given preference. So therefore, we get the Muslim refugees, very few Christian refugees. So these are all ways in which Islam is dictating the customs and habits and civilization of America. So, welcome to a Sharia America, because it's there whether you see it or not. Thank you.
After I watched this, I looked up to see what religion he is, because he was kind of defending Christians. He's a Buddhist.
did you fact check any of that stuff that he said about it, that this OIC approves?
Well, what does Kafir mean? I thought it meant Catholic.
No, Kafir is non-Muslim.
Is that it?
Oh.
K-A-F-F-E-R?
K-A-F-E-R, I think. Kafir. Kafir.
I thought that word was around. I've heard that word a lot.
Those were in South Africa.
Yeah.
The names of the blacks there. They're very tall people, and they're Kafirs.
Yeah, that's what I thought.
It's very similar to the German word Käfer, which means insect.
Oh,
I thought the word was infidel.
Yeah,
it
is.
It means bug.
What?
Bug. The German word. Kefa means bug or beetle or insect.
No, I looked that up too, and Kefir, as he's using it, is a non-Muslim. It's anybody that's not a Muslim.
Anyway, I think some of the statements he made, I would like to see some numbers on that. You know, I those flat statements, they somehow turn me off.
Yeah, I wonder about that. No Christian refugees from Syria. I find that hard to believe.
Yeah.
Well, they could come in through another process.
But they can't be Syrian refugees.
But through the United Nations or whoever is going through all this, they turn over who gets to come to that group, he said.
Christians
could probably come some other route.
I even find that hard to believe, that there's a... If you're a refugee, you have to be of the right religion in order to be a refugee.
Well, they get screened, he's saying, they get screened by this other organization that's a Muslim organization that the U.S. has given the okay. You screen the Muslims to come in.
The U.S. is kind of bad about that, turning it over. They got a hard decision, I'll turn it over to somebody else.
Called privatization. Okay, next.
I saw a video with Bill Maher, and in it he talked about the fact that liberals criticize him when he criticizes Islam, in particular when he criticizes how Islam treats women. And he says, why should liberals attack me when I attack the thing that is trying to destroy liberal principles? And I thought he made an excellent point. So I thought I would expand on his ideas a little more, and I went to Wikipedia and looked up liberal values. Now, the values, it turns out, not only liberal, but I think conservative as well, but they're certainly values highly prized in our civilization. Let's start with freedom of speech. I believe in full-throated freedom of speech. I don't believe in hate laws or in regards to speech. I want full-throated. But be that as it may, Islam does not believe in freedom of speech at all. As an example, blasphemy is when you criticize or condemn Muhammad. Well, I don't think there should be blasphemy laws, and yet Islam does. So I get criticized when I criticize Islam because Islam does not want freedom of speech. That's odd, isn't it? Then we have freedom of the press. I'm a big believer in freedom of the press, which I see as sort of a commercial version of freedom of speech. And freedom of the press is not here in a world today that self-censors itself. Why? Because they don't want to offend Islam. I get offended. Why can't Islam be offended? Then we have freedom of religion. Now, even if you're an atheist, I think you would believe in freedom of religion. But Islam does not believe in freedom of religion. It believes in apostasy laws. That is, if you leave Islam, you can be killed. I don't like apostasy laws. I believe in freedom of religion, and I criticize Islam for its apostasy rules. But I get criticized as being Islamophobe. Then we have artistic freedom. Every liberal believes in artistic freedom, as do progressives, and for that matter, I believe in it as well. And I don't consider myself either liberal or conservative. I'm so at odds with most people, I call myself a dissident. But I certainly believe in artistic freedom. Islam doesn't. And I get criticized for criticizing Islam. Then we have civil rights. Every liberal, every progressive believes in civil rights. I think conservatives believe in civil rights as well. But Islam does not believe in civil rights, and I criticize them for that because they have a category, a legal category, called kafir, who are at best third-class citizens in the Islamic government. And speaking of government, I believe in separation of church and state, which I think that most liberals and conservatives and progressives and leftists believe as well. I don't want a theocracy, and yet Islam prescribes a theocracy. I believe in democratic society. Islam does not believe in a democratic society because a democratic society has the kafir and the believer being equal, which violates the rules of the Sharia. I criticize Islam for this, and I'm criticized for being Islamophobe. I believe in a secular government, separation of church and state. Islam does not. So therefore, when I criticize Islam's theocracy, I get criticized for being an Islamophobe. Now these principles, which I think that most liberals, most conservatives, most progressives, most even leftists believe in, why is it, Bill Maher and myself, when I say the word we, why is it that anyone who criticizes Islam and its inhibitions on all these rights, that we get criticized as being Islamophobe? There's something very upside down here. The very principles that we defend by attacking Islam, we get attacked by saying, oh, Bill Maher, oh, Bill Warner, you're a bad person because you criticize Islam. Yes, I do criticize Islam, and I do so under freedom of speech, and I want that to continue to happen. Don't you? Thank you.
Okay, and the last one is, I thought it was going to be more of an upbeat on winning the jihad war, but it's really not. There's about 8 minutes of why we're not winning and 1 minute maybe of how what we can do to win.
Time in history after the Orlando Gay Club shooting jihad. Now, let's cover quickly why that the homosexuals were picked out by the Muslim jihadists in order to be killed. Then let's deal with the question of why are we losing the jihad war? Because in this jihad attack, there were 50 kafirs, non-Muslims killed, and the death of one Muslim. That's a 50-to-1 kill ratio. That's called losing the battle. First off, the Quran condemns homosexuality, calls them sodomites, but it doesn't really give a penalty. But when we go to the Hadith, the traditions of Muhammad, the perfect Muslim, we find that there's plenty of reasons to kill homosexuals. If you find anyone doing as Lot's people did, that is being homosexuals, kill the one who does it and the one to whom it is done. Another Hadith from Dawood. If a man who is not married is seized committing sodomy, he will be stoned to death. So, now we come to the Sharia. The Sharia is the codification of Islamic law. in the reliance of the traveler. Kill the one who sodomizes and the one who lets it be done. May Allah curse him who does what Lot's people did. So here we have the fact that in Islam, the Islamic text for law called for the killing of homosexuals. So that's one reason homosexuals are chosen to be killed. But let's deal now with the question of why do we keep losing this war? And if you want to know why we're losing the war, just look at what we say after something like this happens. This man is called a lone wolf. Well, he was not a lone wolf, this jihadist. He had as his companions Muhammad and Allah. Muhammad was the perfect jihadist. He was involved in exactly 100 events of jihad. And then the Allah calls for jihad again and again in the Quran. So even if he was working by himself, he has the guidance of Allah, the guidance of Muhammad, and the guidance of 1,400 years of history. So in Islam, there really is no such thing as a lone wolf. Then we have the stupidity of the thing, if you see something, say something. I see this every time I go to the airport. And I know this, that it's not the way it works. The way it works is don't see and don't tell. Because as we're seeing after this shooting jihad event, there were people who worked with him who said, he talked a lot about hateful things. But why was he never called in for it? Because he's a Muslim. We don't criticize Muslims. They're a protected class. Another reason we're losing this war is we refuse to accept for the Sharia for what it is. The Sharia is Islamic law, and it gets a free pass because it says, oh, the Sharia is just like Jewish law or Catholic canon law. No, it is not. The Sharia calls for the killing of homosexuals. The Sharia calls for the punishment by jihad against the kafir, the non-Muslim, and it says that the kafir should not be a part of the legal system in which he has anything really to say. So Sharia is evil in part and evil in the whole of it. We should condemn Sharia as being a hate document. Then we have the other one. Oh, well, this is extremism. Jihad is not an extremist act because 24% of the Quran in Medina deals with jihad. How can we call something which is a mainline doctrine extreme? It is not extreme. Jihad is normative. Jihad is the way that Muhammad rose to power. Then we hear the business of, well, they're extremist imams. There was an imam, and this is going around the web now, who called for the killing of homosexuals and said it was an act of compassion. This man who said that is not an extremist imam because we've already heard that the hadith calls for the killing of homosexuals and that the Sharia text calls for the killing of them as well. So there are no extremist imams. There are simply imams who teach the entirety of the Quran. Another reason we're losing is we're waiting for Islam to reform itself. How do you reform something? The Quran is perfect, complete, universal, and eternal. How do you reform that? Do you add something to it, or do you take something away? Or do you just change it? But remember, it is perfect. So how can you reform something that is perfect? The Sunnah of Muhammad is perfect as well. So therefore, there can be no reform of Islam. And we're fooling ourselves and we say, well, Islam will be fine as long as it has the Reformation. Islam will not be fine with the Reformation because the Reformation, going back to the prime source documents, has been done by the Taliban, Islamic State, Boko Haram, and many others. So there is no such thing as reform that's going to happen to Islam. Then we need to make something clear here. Muslims are not to be the target. We do not need to pick on Muslims or treat them as a hated people. But we do need to hold every Muslim responsible for what the Islamic doctrine says. Then we have the other one. Well, it's their religion. And we don't criticize religion. Actually, we do criticize religion as long as it's Christianity. But Islam is a religion and a political system. We don't need to criticize the religion. We need to criticize the political system. The political system is how it deals with a non-believer. Another reason we're losing the jihad wars is politicians. The politicians have created a law enforcement system which does not allow training on the doctrine of jihad inside of law enforcement itself. So we have our own law enforcement are flying blind because they're not allowed to study and educate themselves about the problem, which is the Islamic doctrine of jihad. Then we have the pathetic clergy, sweet, nice, kind, compassionate people who have no backbone and are silent in the face of the ongoing, everyday persecution of Christians in Africa and the Middle East. There are more than 50 people who have been killed called Christians in Africa, but our clergy, they never bring it up because they don't want to be bigots. Then we have the media. Do we need to spend much time on this? Because the media is now beginning to be involved in actual out-and-out censorship. The media only presents one side and one point. The media never connects the dots. And so therefore, each jihad event is like, when it's big enough to be put in, it's like, oh my goodness, look at this. Well, don't be shocked and surprised. It's just like the other one. And then another reason we're losing the war is the universities do not allow debate on the subject of Islam. They don't teach the true history of Islam. Everything about Islam in our universities is just wonderful, you know. So our universities are selling us out. Now, one of the things that attempted to deter us from seeing that this is jihadist called a killing a hate crime, but killing kafirs is not a hate crime. How do I know this? Because Muhammad killed kafirs. He killed Jews, he killed pagans, he killed Christians. So therefore, killing kafirs is not a hate crime, but a normative doctrine. Now, what's the solution for all of this? And there is a solution. Here's the solution on a bumper sticker. It's the Islam, stupid. We must face the fact that Islam has a doctrine of persecution of the non-Muslim. We need to teach this doctrine in our schools and educate our law enforcement with it. We need to hold every Muslim responsible for all of Islam. Everyone knows a nice Muslim at work or some equivalent, but do we ever discuss the 100 acts of jihad with them? Do we ever discuss the fact that the hadith call for killing gays? No, no, no. We don't bring up any of these bad things about Islam because we don't want to offend a Muslim. Well, every Muslim needs to be held responsible for the entire doctrine of Islam. Every Muslim, without exception, believes there is no God but Allah and Muhammad is his prophet. We need to hold him responsible for what Allah has in the Quran. We need to hold him responsible for what Muhammad did. Then the other thing we need to do is realize that this is a political war, an information war. This is not a war to be won with bullets and bombs. We will defeat Islam not with F-15s, not with guided missiles, but we will defeat Islam by the simple way we defeat other political systems. We're in the middle of a presidential campaign now. I can criticize Hillary, I can criticize Obama, and I can criticize Trump. We need to criticize Muhammad in the same way. We need to use ridicule, irony, humor, and criticism of a political system. We need to use political tools against a political system. We don't need to kill people, we don't need to tell lies, we just need to tell the truth about Islamic doctrine. That's what we need to do. It's the Islam, stupid. Thank you.
I wonder what he meant.
Yeah. Okay.
Well, that was interesting. Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you.
I did find it interesting. And I have to admit, I did not, haven't vetted his statistics out because, you know, I'm kind of gullible that way, I guess. If the double PhD says it, I just kind of, well, okay, what else? You know, but it's worth looking into a few things. But I believe he's... what he says about Islam, he is an expert on the Quran, and he's looked into it for many years.
It seems to me like you could do, in computer speak, a global search and replace for Quran/Bible and Muslim/fundamentalist Christian, and he would be making pretty much the exact same points.
Yeah, it seems like, you know, you almost replace the word Islam with Abrahamism.
Well, no, I mean Christian. Just
no, but everything, you know, like the history of Christianity and, you know, the Old Testament. I mean, a lot of stuff, a lot of Islam comes right out of there. You know, it's identical. It's, you know, supposedly we've outgrown it and they haven't, but, you know.
The Old Testament.
Yeah, the Old Testament, yeah. It's the same.
It's still the perfect word according to a lot of crazy evangelicals. You know, the Bible's perfect, you don't need to change it.
Oh yeah, yeah, it's so much like
Word of God.
Most of us have moved on from that though.
But what does it mean to move on? It's like, should every Christian be responsible for the behavior of the extremes? I notice you said let's substitute extreme Christian.
That's the easy one. Now, if you want to go even further, let's go to all the way.
Yeah, it's an interesting question.
The easy one is
like,
extreme, because they really believe that crap.
You know, if you're not killing every non-Christian you run into, or every non-Abrahamist you run into, you're defying the Old Testament.
Well, how about every gay? Now you've got it covered on both sides.
Every what?
If you're not killing all the gays right away.
Oh, right, them too, yeah.
Like, whether you're Christian or a Muslim, you just whack them down, you know.
You mean Christians also are...
Absolutely. Look at the Old Testament. It says smite them or something.
Yeah.
Something.
Oh, yeah, there's...
Leviticus and Deuteronomy are just as bad.
Right.
Oh, yeah.
No difference.
Right? And my understanding, I haven't looked into it that much, but supposedly the Theodosian Code, which was... Well, Theodosius, I believe, was emperor about... two or three after Constantine. And it's like, hey, if a woman gets raped and she doesn't scream loud enough in protest, she gets stoned. That could have been right into Sharia law. I mean, it
sounds like George Carlin.
Yeah, look what happened to him, right? Hmm? Look what happened to him. He's dead, isn't he?
Who?
George Carlin?
Yeah.
I wish we could change the word Islamophobe. Because I think it's quite natural to fear the religion. And I don't... People really use it, you hate the religion. Yeah, and
that's a good point. I'd go with...
Yeah. You can fear something without hating it. You know, and to call someone an Islamophobe based on my understanding of Islam is quite normal, natural, and it's not something you can really control. But, what they're accusing him of is actually hating the religion.
Who are the people that call people Islamophobes? Is that a group of some sort?
It tends to be the progressive liberal.
Yeah, I was just trying to get you to say that.
I didn't want to say it myself. So there's a problem there, isn't there?
When a fellow liberal called him an Islamophobe because he was bringing up these statistics about Muslims and Islam, and I don't know, 70% of Muslims believe that, but only 2% do anything about it, but that's the point he was bringing up.
Ian, where did the story of Goldsmith College in London about the hypocrisy of the new progressive liberal? The Atheist Society invited an ex-Muslim woman to speak, and the university Islamic group said no, she's been banned from other universities in England. She's not going to speak. The university didn't make a decision, and she was allowed to speak. The Islamic Society showed up at her talk and disrupted it. You can see it on YouTube. And disrupted it and shut it down. So there was a big argument about, you know, this is not right, you know, free speech. Well, the university feminist, came out on the side of the Islamic group because they're a protected group.
Right.
And it just seemed, you know, a lot of feminists said this is, it caused quite a split because a lot of feminists said, oh, wait a minute, you know, they really want to kill us. Why are we defending them? Because they're a protected group. And the whole rationale behind their stance was completely just illogical and hypocritical.
Are they a protected group?
Yeah, I think this is five. I can't remember this LGBTQT plus or whatever.
They're a religious minority in the United States.
Women.
Okay. I was under the impression that for many years, if not decades, that the overwhelming majority of religious scholars, Christian scholars, have disavowed the Old Testament completely as myth and having nothing to do with Christianity. Is that?
You mean like Rick Santorum and all the Republican candidates?
Right.
Those are not Christian scholars.
Oh, okay.
Is that not right?
Well,
it depends on who you listen to.
Jews are basically the Old
They're
Testament.
They're not Christians. I'm talking about Christian scholars. Because most of the stuff...
Yeah.
If you're a Southern Baptist, no, I'd say they're in with the old guys.
They're not Christian scholars either.
But they are Christians.
They are Christians.
There are no scholars in the Baptist.
I'm talking about Christian scholars whose job it is to study Christianity. And they came to the conclusion, overwhelmingly years ago, that the Old Testament is mostly myth and has nothing to do with Christianity. That's the New Testament. Right. And am I the only one here that knows
who
that?
Who are these people who represent Christianity that are doing this?
College professors. Researchers.
When they look at Christianity, they're looking at which... I mean, Christianity is so fragmented in belief.
Right. I'm sure that's true, actually. However, there's so many, Christian crazies around that ignore them. So what difference does it make what they say?
But somehow, I guess the word hasn't gotten around, except
that's the problem.
But, all of the crazy stuff that you were quoting has been disavowed by people who should know what they're talking about and have published it and blah, blah, blah. Because I read about it years ago.
If you're a true theist, it's not crazy stuff.
Pardon?
If you're a true theist, it's not crazy stuff.
I find it's crazy stuff when you corner a Christian, and they'll say, the Old Testament, we really don't take that serious.
That's right.
But it's not a real disavowal. It's just like an excuse to get out of.
You're not perfect. There's no kind of perfect.
Well, this was Constantine that put the Old Testament in the Bible, and then he could have just as well left it out.
Hey, I'm in favor of just crossing out the whole thing, the new and everything in between.
Well, the whole thing, the interesting connection, you're talking about Constantine. The whole Council of Nicaea was about one principal issue. And that was whether they were going to accept Orthodox Christianity or Arianism. There was Libyan preacher, prophet named Arius. And he taught almost exactly what Islam taught, that Jesus Christ was a prophet.
Straight up.
Was not the Son of God. There is no such thing as the Trinity. And so he lost. He got exiled for it from the Council of Nicaea.
Yeah, they did the Christian thing. They killed him.
No, they didn't. They just exiled him.
Oh, okay.
They let him back in again, and he misbehaved again.
Huh? You're talking about Constantine?
Well, this is the Council of Nicaea.
He appointed them.
Right, but he invited people. There was one issue to discuss, and that was whether or not
this happened.
He's going to fix it.
It's the voice of God.
Oh, my God.
He'll be for us.
Whether the Trinity existed or not. It was the whole big thing, and the Arians lost. But studying Arianism... It ended just about the time that Mohammedism began. And I've always believed that that was the origin of Islam. Because they took over in areas, Islam started in areas where Arianism was strong and Orthodox Christianity was. And then after Islam took over, you never heard of Arianism again.
Until Hitler came along.
Well, that's the wrong kind. He wasn't thinking of the Libyan prophet.
okay.
What do people think about the difference between Islam and Islamism?
What is the difference?
What do you mean?
You mean Islamism like as a political organization?
To distinguish between the crazies and the nice folk, the nice Muslim folk. They're saying you can't criticize Islam. You're really talking about Islamism.
As the political system.
Well, I think I'm not sure I agree with the distinction between.
Well, Dr. Warner would say there's nothing wrong with jihadists. They're just following the rules.
Well, he said there's nothing wrong. There's nothing inconsistent.
Yeah, I think. Yeah, actually, I like that word better. It's morally wrong, obviously. Well, to me, it's obvious anyway. And I'm not a Christian either. But, you know, I mean, you just cannot go on and...
Probably damn few Christians in this room. Right?
I hope.
But I'm glad you pointed that out.
I have to wonder if one of the reasons why we don't go after Islam is that if you go deeper... I mean, you got to start to attack the fundamental reasonings behind the religion. Say, no, you know, there's... That's impossible. It can't be, you know, like a God that created all this. You know, once you start to attack Islam at its roots, you're starting to attack Christianity and Judaism.
Absolutely,
they're all. So it gets a little too close to the root.
You started to believe. You started to attack the belief in something that nobody's ever seen, heard,
right,
smelled.
Right, right, right. But specifically, you're going to attack the two fundamental groups of our. Culture, which is Christians and Jews. Help but do that.
Where did the taboo start of criticizing anybody's religion?
The taboo?
Yeah, it's a taboo in our society. Where did that... How'd that get started?
Because we follow the golden rule, you know. We don't want to offend other people.
And it's enshrined in the Constitution.
But you know, that doing to others is, if I were acting foolishly and somebody would criticize me for it, I don't think that's... Because I could criticize them for acting foolishly too.
Wow.
But they would take offense at it if I criticized their religion. If they criticized my haircut... I wouldn't take offense.
I was
going
to talk to you about that.
Now I get your point, but for some reason, you know, we don't criticize religion. It's taboo. It's kind of off the table. I think
where'd that get started?
Yeah,
well,
but
it's
on bottom.
It's fear.
Yeah.
You know, the reason they didn't reproduce the cartoons, the hip papers, was just because they're out of fear.
Well, no.
Fear of reprisal.
I know.
It's not a taboo in terms of self. It's more self censorship out of.
I think it's a societal thing.
I bet we're all similar though. When I'm out with another couple or whatever, I don't bring up religion. I don't bring up politics, except maybe if I hear an opening. But I'm not.
That's true. It's politeness.
I'm not going to do that because it's offensive. It could be offensive to them if they're a born again Christian.
But take for instance, if they started killing homosexuals. Christians started killing homosexuals.
Or you mean like abortion doctors?
Or abortion doctors.
You'd speak out against that religion, wouldn't you? Or not? Would you criticize them if...
Well, they don't speak out as much as...
Pardon?
People are a little bit mooted even about criticizing...
Well, I know, and I think it's wrong. I think that's a basic problem in our society.
But you're not going to bring it up. In a social setting.
Yeah, we're gonna invite the Joneses on and say, "Say, how do you feel about those
abortion doctors getting killed?" Probably not.
You want to be sociable.
But
depending on the opening, I might say, well, "What did Jesus Christ really say on the cross?"
So you're saying it's out of self-interest that you don't criticize someone's religion?
No, it's out of politeness. In social settings. I mean, you can do anything you want.
I mean, when people are dying needlessly, self-interest can go to hell, as far as I'm concerned. I mean, some things need to be said.
Sure.
But you're having steak and a bottle of wine.
Politeness, I don't think, is a good excuse.
But you're probably not going to bring it up.
Yeah, not with your...
If they bring it up, that's one thing, but you're not going to start the conversation about it. what do you think about this? Well, maybe you could, but chances are you wouldn't, because you don't want to start a subject that you're really not sure where it's going to go with, especially if you're with some friends.
I think a lot of that has also to do with the way the U.S. was founded, you know, in the Constitution, where they would allow freedom of religion and rather than freedom from religion. but they went the other way, you know, freedom of religion. Whereas in the UK, or at least that's what it's called now, you know, there was once state religion, and now in the country I'm from, there was, and there still is for that matter, is one state religion. And as a result, there are other religions, but there are much fewer. But in the U.S., there must be at least 10,000 different brands of Christianity, and every one has its own God. I mean, you know, the... it's amazing that there's still light coming down there with all these gods in the way.
Well, they're transparent.
I didn't know that. But, see, I've never seen one.
Oh, you can't see it.
Oh, I see.
Okay. If you have free speech, can religion say the hateful things it does? Or, sure, it's only what people do that counts.
Yeah, well...
Right? So, you know, when it says we hold all Muslims accountable for the words in the Quran, but I believe in free speech. What is he saying?
But the same thing applies again to Christians.
Oh yeah, I mean, it's just in Christians. Most Christians ignore the call to kill the abortion doctors.
I would say probably in the United States,
most Muslims ignore it too.
Yeah. So what does it mean to be held accountable?
Exactly. It's meaning. It's bullshit.
Yeah.
No, but they're as accountable as the crazy Christians.
They're only accountable from their actions, right?
Right, sure. We don't have thought police yet.
Yeah.
We're working on it.
Yeah.
It looks like the way the talk that we just saw, they were all quite recent, weren't they? I mean, he was referring to Obama and Clinton and...
Oh yeah, in the recent Florida massacre.
These must have been within the last couple of three or four weeks.
Yeah, the last one was fairly recent.
I have to think that one of the reasons why Europe is that the number of non-believers there is so much greater than in the United States is I think they're just a lot more educated in general than we are. I think they have more school. I think they have a lot more critical thinking. I think
they have also lived through more recent hard times.
That too. But I just think they think more clearly than people, than all, you know, a lot of people in the United States who just are told this is the way it is, and then they just believe it.
Well, I'm from England, so Church of England is your default religion unless you state something else. So when you're filling out a form, you have to actively say no. Or else it's CLE. You know, so no. And it just, it's another government department.
How many people who are in the Church of England believe in God?
Oh, do you mean who are by default?
Yes, Christians. Exactly. How many default Church of Englanders believe in God? A very small percentage.
I think it's that disconnect between being labeled something.
Exactly. But not in the United States. Not in the United States.
I think
that's the difference. And I think the difference is because people in England go to school. And
but we have mandated religious instruction.
Yeah.
It's a government mandate that we attend religious instruction.
You guys speak more languages. You guys are more educated
Christian instruction? Or
I don't know what it is now. When I was at school, we had to get the Bibles out.
Yeah.
And we had little illustrated Bibles, which we all doodled in.
It
just became another chore. Lost any sort of spirituality.
Yeah.
It was just another class you took.
In Holland, it's Protestantism that is the official religion. But, in the south of Holland, most everybody is Roman Catholic. But actually, when you go to school, they don't have any... any religious requirements or part of the curriculum. It's not there, but it is being offered on the side. You know, like you come back on a Saturday afternoon for an hour and listen to somebody who is telling you all the good things about God and whatever. But this is not, it's not a must. And you said in England, you do have to read the Bible.
It's well, you can get dispensation. In our assembly, we used to sing hymns, but the Catholics used to be sent to a little room where they didn't have to participate.
Yeah.
And then they come in for the general notices after we had the Bible reading. This was a public school.
So I'm a born-again atheist. In the previous life, I was a Mormon, and I can tell you that in school there, they are there's no religion in the schools.
No.
No. You can't take seminary. It's usually off-site, a block away or across the street,
yeah, right,
or whatever, and you go there to take a class once a day.
So it's the same thing then.
Yeah, same thing. And but you know, in Utah anyway, the religion is more insidious. It's, you know, when you get together, you're going to say a prayer before you eat.
Everybody is a hormone.
Yeah,
hormone.
You just have to do it.
So you live in Salt Lake City?
No, but I have relatives in Salt Lake City.
I worked one summer in Salt Lake City, and they used to always make, but I guess us non-Mormons made the joke about who's the guy in the square? Is that Brigham Young or
Angel Moroni?
No, there's another guy.
The one way on the top.
No, there's somebody like
Brigham Young, probably.
Okay. So they say, look at Brigham Young. He's there in the square. He's got his hand towards the church and his ass towards the church. I mean, his hand towards the bank and his ass towards the church.
And he had a bunch of wives, too.
So. Oh, I'm sure. He could afford them.
But back to the point, I guess, that I think in the U.S. There is pretty good separation of church and state, but it's has to be fought all the time. That's why the Freedom from Religion Foundation I support. And
I was just wondering, since this is very contemporary, that maybe we ought to send a little email to this Dr. Warner and tell him that, in our opinion, almost everything he says goes for Christianity as well.
Right.
And,
that's a good point.
Maybe he should broaden, his point of view.
Why pick on the Muslims?
Yeah. Exactly.
I wonder. Sort of semi-protected status of the Muslims. How much does that have to do with their financial clout? And I don't know how much financial clout they really have.
I think it's political correctness more than financial clout.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah. They don't have a lot of financial
clout. I've heard a town in England called Rotherham. Rotherham, I've only heard it mentioned one time in the Mexican newspapers. There was a scandal broke out, a pedophile scandal broke out.
Yeah.
And there was something like 4,000 cases over several years. And it was Pakistani taxi drivers who were grooming young girls, picking them up outside school, giving them...
I did hear something about that.
And they said, well, how come there's so many? How come it went on for so long? And everyone knew. The teachers knew. The police knew.
Right.
The council knew. And they said, we knew it was all Muslims grooming the girls, and they took them to other cities to be trained because they didn't want to use their own money. They just kept a lid on it because they didn't want to cause any racial unrest or religious unrest.
Right.
It was an incredible scandal.
Here in Mexico?
No, this was in Rotterdam. It's a small steel town in the north of England.
Oh, north of England.
Yeah. And it was just, it was going on for years. It was thousands and thousands of cases. Everyone knew. And it was suppressed because they didn't want to offend. Ironically, when it came out, a lot of the Muslims came down and said, there was a big town meeting, said, oh, you know, we're not all like those taxi drivers. You know, we don't all ascribe to those. And someone said, well, where are the women? It was all men.
Yeah.
And where were you when it was going on?
Yeah.
Wow.
Maybe as well.
Sure.
Yeah. Everybody knew. Incredible. But what, you know, is Islam really a threat to the West?
It seems to me like there's a threat to just about everybody.
More than,
you know, the big scheme of things, it's no threat. No.
Okay.
No. We're already suffering when you go through TSA at the airport.
It's that kind of threat, right?
That
over our freedoms.
That kind of threat is altering my life because I fly a lot. And I get so furious. I mean, at the Heathrow Airport, I was screened by a Muslim woman in a burqa.
You're kidding.
No. And it just infuriated the hell out of me. I mean, like, they think 70-year-old Caucasian men cause a lot of problems on airplanes.
No, it's not that. It's you.
The thing that really scares me is that some of these fanatics are willing to blow themselves up, along with everybody else.
Yeah, and that's really
puts a whole new light on the whole thing.
And you have one shoe bomber, and for 10 years later, billions of people have to take off their shoes.
Oh, for sure. America,
yeah,
for the worse.
Right. Oh, yeah.
And it's only going to get worse yet, because they've just begun.
Personally, I think we overreacted. And we shouldn't give up personal freedoms for additional safety.
The solution is everybody fly nude. You ever seen a naked terrorist?
I haven't, but the underwear bomber, that was close.
That was close.
I have a picture of that somewhere.
There's
an airplane full of naked people.
Oh, yeah, well, there was a
this is a joke, but went around for several years. And so somebody made a picture, I think a flop of nudists, and they took this picture. And,
But it was a flight.
I don't know if it was a real flight.
No, it was a real thing, you know. They had to sit on towels, and... I forgot when they could take their clothes off, but it was a whole flight of nudists that came maybe to Mexico.
No terrorists on board.
Yeah, but if you go to Google images, I'm sure you're going to find this picture, you know.
Yeah.
Anyway, well, it's really a sad thing, you know, and this guy is so how would you say it?
Focused.
Yeah, focused. Yeah, but I really think he should really include Christianity, because we all agree. I mean, there is really not that much.
Yeah, difference. I wonder if you did the equivalent amount of research that he's done on the Old Testament in particular, you could come up with almost
I'd be surprised if he had done. You know, some Old Testament research, because it is so connected to Islam.
Well, kind of to back up, he started this crusade after 9/11, basically, and devoted his attention to Islam. So, I mean, a person can only do so much.
That's true. Then you get to the point you don't know who to believe in your research.
Have you ever tried to read the Quran?
I never
impossible.
Have.
Impossible.
Yeah,
it is impossible.
I can't make out the letters to begin with.
Well, you weren't trying to read it. Oh, you were trying to read it in the original language.
That's the only one.
That's the only way to do it. Well, you should go study
Arabic,
so you can do that.
Yeah, right.
As a researcher, you should be in the original script.
Yeah, right.
There is a book, and I want to get it. I've been putting it off. It's fairly recent. It's by a German author, and it's forbidden in all Islamic countries. His thesis is that the Quran is a badly translated version of a Syriac version of the New Testament.
Old Testament.
When I said new, now I've looked into it, but that's what I said.
It can't be the New Testament.
Well, now remember,
it would have to be really badly translated.
The Quran acknowledges Jesus Christ as a prophet. Anyway, he does claim that some of the wording of the Quran is due to the fact that there simply weren't words to translate from Syriac to Arabic, and they just put some words in. I don't know, but it's not my homework to do that.
Well, it's explicitly stated in the New Testament that Jesus wasn't here to change anything.
I'm sorry?
Or invalidate anything in the Old Testament. He was asked whether you could reject Mosaic law, and now that he's arrived to deliver this enlightenment, he says, no, not a job.
Jesus
said yes.
I understand that Jesus never said anything. Zero, silt.
Well, that's
no words.
But other people said he said yes.
Yeah. Other people said
yes.
It is somebody said that Jesus said, but Jesus never said anything. I mean, you know, nobody actually knows even if he existed.
Well, that's true. But assuming that he did, the fact is that, I mean, his mission, I understand it, he was a rabbi. He was a Jewish teacher. He never had any intention of starting a new religion or teaching to the Gentiles. That the great snake oil salesman, Paul, whatever he was, he's the one that did that.
But there was hundreds and hundreds of prophets back then.
Oh, yeah.
And they were all pissed off at the Romans.
Right.
Although pissed off at the establishment Jews, because Palestine was one of the few places where the Romans allowed the religion to flourish
in
exchange for leaving them alone.
Right. Under Herod, particularly.
Yeah.
Things clamped down after that.
Yeah. So the average Palestinian saw the Jewish powers that be as colluding with the Romans.
What was the name of that Roman historian?
Josephus?
Yeah, was that the one at the time of Christ or everything?
Yeah.
And, you know, you would think that if this guy that they crucified for being a prophet or whatever, what charge they got him on.
Sedition.
And then he arose from the dead 3 days later, would have at least got a few lines on page 13 of Josephus's manual, because he was there.
Yeah, but the New York Times was not in business yet.
I read a book and gave a book report here a year or so ago about did Jesus really exist? And what was interesting is that during that time, Rome had many historians living at that time, and they wrote every day about everything that was going on in town.
Except
nothing about Jesus.
Right, that's exactly right.
Not one word.
Yeah, that's exactly
Until
right.
Until about 60 years later, then they started writing stuff.
No, they were all busy with the Cardassians.
Well, yeah.
Who were the Cardassians?
But, nobody was alive that was writing about Jesus Christ. Nobody was alive at his time. They were always after, and they were writing about hearsay things.
But how many people rise from the dead? I mean, surely that would be newsworthy. I mean, it never happens, does it? Have you ever?
Oh, I wouldn't say
that. I don't know of any writing.
No, I can't think of another instance.
Yeah. See, so, but you don't know if he was really dead when they put him in there.
Well, he's missing, but that's not even in the writing anywhere that his body's missing. You know?
An interesting point about that is, I read in one book, you know, they talked about the cave he was in or the tomb. Okay, that would have had to been a private tomb. And only rich people had private tombs. So Jesus had some real rich friends and he had a private tomb to go into.
That's a given, yeah.
I think it makes much more sense to believe that this whole Christian religion was thought up by Paul.
He took it and ran with it. You know, that whole thing was his enterprise. You know, it's
everything is just make believe. You know, and people are just gullible. They, for some reason or other, need to have something to believe in somehow. I guess they don't trust themselves.
Well, I still believe that religion was a necessary evolutionary step.
Not sure about necessary.
And it's, that it is now time to move beyond it. And it's not easy,
yeah.
You know. Like as an atheist group or whatever, I often wonder, well, shouldn't we have some responsibility to convince people? Well, you actually don't need that. You can live well without it. Yeah. You know, it's just like a crutch that you can get rid of.
I've been an atheist all my life. I mean, it's just, you know, I never knew I was. I mean, I was never a believer. And, in fact, I did believe once in Santa Claus. But then when I got a little older, something like that. But, no, Santa Claus in Holland is somebody who comes on a horse.
Oh, okay.
And, you know, and anyway. But pretty much like Father Christmas, you know, and... But, you know, you reach the age of 8 or so, and then that was the last thing I believed in.
I was a real religious little bastard.
Oh, well.
It was when, in Sunday school, and I asked the question, who wrote the Bible? And that was the beginning of the end.
I discovered one day that... If you believe in any paranormal kind of a thing, well, then you believe in everything. Opens up everything.
Yeah.
If you believe anything outside of physics, then you believe in God or something.
Or you could say you can easily believe in God. I mean, it's just like believing in anything else that is beyond understanding.
If you believe a person can do something that violates the laws of physics, you believe in God. Because there's no other explanation for me.
Well, gentlemen, I don't want to miss my cocktail.
No, you can't blame me.
Have another cocktail here. You're at the cocktail.
Thanks again for the video.
All right, okay. Thank you.
So there's not going to be a meeting next month, correct?
I'm saying there is not going to be a meeting next month unless somebody volunteers to be the chairman of that meeting. Because Henry and I are gone, and I don't want to try to do things from afar.
No, I do it, but I just can't do it. Sorry. Yeah, well, you know.
Put earplugs in.
It's more than that. It's just, I don't know what happens from time to time, but, you know. I just don't feel very good.
Philip, if you do it once, you'll want to do it for a year or so.
I was thinking of contacting John Studgett and see whether he wanted to
I was hoping he would be here.
Have a ding-dong about, maybe dualism and his objections to our mechanistic universe.
I've read,
we share many...
I've read all those emails. That would be interesting discussion. I've always thought that it would be great to have debates, and we had one debate with Rich and you.
Yeah.
And that was great. I love that. You have a debate, people listen, ask questions, and at the end you kind of vote on who won.
Yeah, right.
And it's a lot better when everyone's not in agreement.
Yeah.
It's a lot more fun. I think with this guy, everybody was sort of agreeing, yeah.
Well,
yeah. We just extended it a little further to include Christianity.
But yeah, I think John wants to participate more, I know. But he doesn't want to be an official, so...
Yeah. Well, maybe for the next time, I'll ask him. I'll see whether he wants... Whether we can have a debate against... The argument against his dualism.
You're talking September or sometime in the future?
Well, either. I mean, I've always wanted to debate him.
If it's September, I need a volunteer to be the chairman.
Okay. Let me contact him.
Okay. And then contact me.
And then if he's willing to do it for this next meeting... You can set it up.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, debates are interesting. Stimulating.
Yeah. And we both I think see one another's point of view, but we definitely don't agree. So
oh yeah.
That's
right.
Always good.
Yeah. Hey, John has some interesting points of view.
Yeah.
Is there my food coming in?
I think you got our food coming in.
Ah, there we go.